I am glad to see you all here. It seems as though we've got a few more seats empty in the chapel here than normally, but that's okay. We've got a lot of church ahead of us here in the very near future. And so I, as a priest for 20 years, and it seems as though it was just yesterday when I was ordained, but a year does not pass when Eastertide comes upon me rushing on like a gigantic tidal wave, and I feel the exhaustion of it all. So it is just fine that we come as we are able. But I did want to begin by saying a word about Passion Sunday, because it is one of those quirks of the old prayer book tradition that we continue here at All Saints and in the Reformed Episcopal Church that has gone away in the new prayer books, either of the mainline Episcopal Church and in the ACNA, that it seems as though that, like the Jessima seasons leading up to Lent, that were just a little bit too antique. But I would simply offer to you this morning, as we consider our lesson from the letter to the Hebrews this morning, that giving an appropriate meditation, time to live into the moment, takes time. We, in the 21st century, at the end of our hyperlinks on our telephones, expect to receive exactly what we want, when we want it, and we'll do it again and again as long as our phone will keep pumping random information into our brains. But the fact of the matter is that now we enter into this season that is called Passiontide, which brings us to the very heart of the Christian message. The very life of the world hangs in the balance. And one week that we customarily call Holy Week, the church has historically said is too short. That we get 2 weeks to think deeply about what God the Father was willing to give on behalf of the life of the world. And so this season, these last 2 weeks going up to the great Paschal feast of Easter, is a quiet time in which the church calls us to meditate deeply upon the death of Christ upon the cross for our salvation. And so we hear in the succeeding gospel lessons, Jesus surrounded by his enemies, accusing him of various crimes and sins against the Torah and against his native-born people, and also the commentary from none other than the letter to the Hebrews, expressing how it is that we as Christians understand the death and the resurrection, the cosmic priesthood of Christ before his Father on behalf of his people. And so in our Hebrews lesson today from the 9th chapter, we hear about Christ coming into the midst of this heavenly tabernacle or tent, or perhaps with a view of the writer at the time, the temple that stood upon the mount there in Jerusalem. We think about the temple services or the tabernacle services presented to us in the Old Testament, and perhaps we think about it as simply an extension of dear old All Saints, a nice place to go for church on Sunday, a nice comfortable seat where you can listen to a perhaps longish homily, and then receive communion or something to that effect. But the service in the temple was nothing like the Christian devotion that we experience day by day, week by week, year by year. For one, there was no place to sit. When you went to the temple in Jerusalem, if you made that great pilgrimage up to God's house in the holy city of Jerusalem, if you made that ascent up to the temple, you didn't ever get a chance to go in, and there was no place for you to sit. It was wholly off limits for the common person. It was attended and populated by ranks upon ranks of Levites and priests going about the daily rounds of sacrifice on behalf of the people, on behalf of themselves, on behalf of the Gentile nations, and on behalf of the high priest himself. There was no place for you to sit. And it was not a place like All Saints in that it's nice and tidy with our lovely altar guild making sure that it's swept up in the corners there and making sure that the garbage is taken out and it's spotlessly clean. But instead, it was more like if you decided that you were going to church on Sunday at the local meat processor. Blood poured out in the corners of the holy places, the smell of burnt hair and flesh hanging around. There was no sense of cleanliness in the modern antiseptic kind of way. There was laws of purity, rigorous laws of purity, but the whole place would have been surrounded by swirling clouds of burning meat and hair and horn and hoof. Day by day, moment by moment, morning and evening, sacrifices for sin, for peace, for goodwill, the cereal offering, the great offerings on the Day of Atonement, all of these, day by day, the endless round of prayer and of sacrifice of animals and blood. As the Epistle to the Hebrews reminds us, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. The priests, of course, couldn't keep up with it all. Father Heaton and I would just flop down dead if we were responsible for it all. There were ranks of Levites and priests who came on and off the rota to make sure that they weren't exhausted, and finally each one of them in their own day did indeed drop dead. And their job was taken up by the next generation who would offer those daily blood sacrifices for themselves and for the people, and for the world. Now we, in our modern wisdom, may sniff at that and say, well, of course, those ancients, they were so superstitious, they didn't really know what they were about. But we shouldn't be quick to rush to judgment about ancient practices of offering blood as some kind of superstition or barbarism. We, here in the modern world, who have witnessed the bloodiest century in the history of the world, we know about shedding of blood, and we cannot judge so easily the ancient world. But so often it is the case that we misunderstand the meaning of the sacrificial impulse from the beginning. The spirit behind a man and a woman, a boy or a girl, coming into the divine presence and offering a sacrifice, an animal, or something else, like waving the wheat offering before the presence of the Lord. But at the very heart of the impulse to offer sacrifice to God is the desire to offer God something that is valuable or precious to us. This love or devotion to the deity elicits from each one across all time and all cultures this impulse to offer to the deity something of your own that is precious to you. But not simply offering something precious, but offering something bloody, which is, of course, astonishing to us moderns. Noah, in the book Genesis, was told not to eat the blood that was within the animal, but instead only the flesh of the animal. There was something peculiar, something special, something, may we say, holy about the blood that coursed within the veins. The book Leviticus, of course, later than the book Genesis, but the book Leviticus puts law to this deep, mysterious understanding. The book Leviticus writes, "The life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it for you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement by reason of the life." You see, my friends, the impulse to offer sacrifice comes from this native or natural or born desire to offer the God something that is precious to us as an offering, as a representative of our devotion, also to offer blood, because the understanding is that the life that we seek to have is within the blood itself. But also, finally, the third impulse to offer sacrifice is that we understand deeply within our hearts, in our consciences, that we ourselves are not worthy to come into the presence of God Himself, the true, most holy, most good, most glorious God cannot see us because we ourselves have sinned and fallen short of that glory. Our lives stand condemned because of our sinfulness, and we cannot come into the divine presence unless that sin has been dealt with. And so you see that the impulse to offer a sacrifice, and not just any preciousness, but instead a bloody sacrifice to deal with that broken relationship, is the desire to come once again into the very presence of God. One mistake that has been made over the years is to assume that somehow the animal itself takes the punishment on our behalf, but that was never the case in the mind of the Old Testament. Instead, the sacrifice was simply offered or killed to gain the blood. The blood is that great cleansing element to cover the sin of the people, and in covering the sin, to restore the broken relationship between God and His people. So we see then in the language of our letter to the Hebrews then that the promise that God Himself made to His people, God Himself has kept for them. God, from the very outset, gave to the Hebrews the sacrificial system, and we see it in all of its replete and minuscule laws, how it was that God demanded to be served through the Pentateuch. He gave it to them as they sought to serve Him, yes, but also looked forward in hope to the moment in which that salvation would come in all of its fullness. God gave this system, this sacrificial system, as a temporary, not a permanent resolution until the perfect came. And when the perfect and final sacrifice came, then that old sacrificial system would be redundant and would pass away. It was good, you see. The language of the letter to the Hebrews is always complementary of that old system. It was a good thing. It was not a mistake, but it was incomplete. It had to be repeated again and again. It had numerous iterations, numerous kinds of sacrifices for numerous kinds of events or sins. It was offered by numerous priests over numerous years. It was a good thing, but it was itself short. It was incomplete. It could not fulfill finally. And so we see then in the mind of our lesson from Hebrews today that Jesus' offering is the perfection, the fulfillment, the summation of all of the hope of the ancient sacrificial system and all of the hope of God's special people. Jesus, Israel's Messiah, her long-awaited King, dies on behalf of His nation and on behalf of the sins of the world. This is the great and deep mystery. But because He died, the result is that now all of those who are in Him no longer have to die. They themselves go free. The great Passover freedom. And finally, that Jesus' offering is the perfect fulfillment in that through His blood, not just some kind of external or ritual purification, that is, now I can come into a special place like the temple in Jerusalem, but through His everlasting and perfect blood, our souls, our deepest selves, are transformed. We are made clean in the most extreme and final way, no longer simply externally, but finally and truly made clean to come into the very presence of God. The letter to the Hebrews tells us that our consciences are made clean. That is, our very selves now have been made right before the living God. But we may rightly ask, how is a dying man nailed to a cross in Palestine 2,000 years ago the answer to all my problems? How many thousands and tens of thousands of young Palestinian men died on Roman crosses. Why is this one in particular unique and finally, ultimately successful? It is because of the fact that he is both God and man, that he takes upon himself all that we are, upon his divine nature, all that he is. And it is through the work of his Holy Spirit, converting our heart and minds, that we ourselves can become God's sons and daughters, children of light. And so we come year by year to this great and holy season. Holy Week, just a week away, the season of Passiontide, nested within the Lenten season, looking forward to the great Paschal feast of Easter, we come each year reminded of this great and deep truth of this final, ultimate sacrifice of Christ upon the cross. As our gospel on Quinquagesima Sunday reminded us, Jesus telling his disciples, "Look here, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will suffer at the hands of his enemies and will be crucified and rise again on the third day. Behold, we go up to Jerusalem." And so each one of us are invited to come to stand at the foot of the cross, to see again his suffering on our behalf, and in it to know the magnitude of God's love for us. The shepherd dies for the sheep. God dies for the world. We come to stand together at the foot of the altar, to see again how Christ's death for sin was once for all, that he fulfilled all of the former sacrifices, and so being fulfilled is now never can again be repeatable. But we stand before the altar because he, on the night in which he was betrayed, gave us a sacrament. That is an outward and visible sign of an inward and spiritual grace by which we, day by day, may receive the great glory and grace which he has won by his death upon the cross. Jesus can never die again. He lives gloriously and eternally. He told his apostles, "Do this in remembrance of me," to proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. We do not repeat Jesus' sacrifice ever again, but we repeat as we come together the great and good, the deepest mysterious good of his sacrament, in which he gives us the effect, the evidence, the life that he poured out for us upon that cross, sure that it is Christ himself who gives us the tokens of that perfect sacrifice every time we receive it. Why do we come each Sunday to receive the sacrament? So that we might be one with him. And being one with his death and resurrection, we now may come in as children into the presence of the Father. But not only unity with the Father, but unity in love with one another. As Jesus himself in the Sermon on the Mount reminded the crowds, "Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them. Then come and offer your gift." Reconciliation, my friends, is not simply between us and God effected by Jesus' death upon the cross, but reconciliation between human beings, once enemies, now made friends by the death of Jesus upon the cross. We, each one, must be willing to forgive because we have been forgiven. We must be at charity, in charity with all men. We must be kind to our wives. We must be loving to our children. We must be peacemakers among those that we meet in our workplaces and in the streets. We must seek reconciliation among all men and all nations. Forgiveness, you see, is what we are offered upon the cross. But it doesn't end with us, but instead we ourselves must be agents of that forgiveness. Amen.